Small Biz America.
The brain.
Our guest on this segment has experienced the full spectrum of mergers and acquisitions in his own career. Author and consultant Dick Stieglitz was an executive in a company that was sold, participated in transactions to buy companies, and built and sold his own company for what experts called a top multiple. Since he sold his company, Dick now consults with CEOs who are grooming their company to be sold or building it through acquisitions. In his new book, Expensive Mistakes When Buying and Selling Companies and How to Avoid Them in Your Deals, Dick shares his insights based on his M&A experiences and includes many interviews with leading investment bankers, M&A attorneys, and CPAs. Joining us on the line from his offices in Washington, D.C. is Dick Stieglitz. Dick, welcome.
Good to be with you, David.
So we're sitting in early, still quarter one of 2010, clearly signs of life in the economy. But how is the economy, this recession, extraordinary times, how is all of this affecting the M&A market from your perspective?
Well, David, it's way off. And the big deals that we read about in the newspaper, Dealogic, which is a New York firm that tracks these kind of things, has told us that the deals among publicly traded firms are off by as much as two-thirds. Among smaller businesses that are privately held, the drop-off isn't quite as bad. It's probably about 50% down from what it was in the peak of 2006 and 2007. Mostly the issue is that banks aren't willing to loan money to do these kind of deals.
So it's a credit crunch problem, by and large.
Yes, very, very few people and even less companies have enough money sitting around to finance the acquisition of a small business. So that's why the banks are not getting involved in these kind of deals. And it's also why that if you are selling your business, you need to be creative on providing financing for the buyer.
Dick, you've dealt with the M&A market for quite a while. What size transactions are you typically working in? I just want to lay the groundwork for your experience base.
I personally consult with the owners typically of firms that are in the range of $3 to $20 million.
Okay.
And are looking to be sold and are thinking of selling their company a year or maybe 2 years from now and want to make it more valuable.
Okay. So for the benefit of our audience, which may be comprised of business owners who are anything from a solopreneur on up to, you know, 15, 20 employees, maybe a $5 million company, do the principles that you work around, is it the same game essentially when you're looking for an exit strategy for a small business owner, or does it change because of the size of the transaction?
No, it's the same kind of thinking, but I find that business owners at the smaller end are doing less of the exit kind of planning than they should be. I recommend to my clients that exit planning should be part of your strategic plan. Well, right away, Dave, we have an issue here because many business owners don't have a strategic plan, so let alone an exit plan. But let's assume they have a strategic plan. There's actually six ways that you can exit from a company that you own. You can sell it to your family, transfer ownership to your family. You can sell it to your management team or your employees. You can sell it to a third party. You can become an absentee owner. You can liquidate the company. And option number six is you can die managing the company forever. Now, none of us want to do option number six. But if we don't have an exit strategy in mind, that's actually the choice that we're picking.
Okay, so by default, that'll happen.
By default, that's the choice we pick, yes.
So early stage, when a business owner calls you and says, Mr. Stieglitz, I need to plan for this, you'll lay out the six options and kind of go through the process, the nuts and bolts of what each of these might look like for them. And then I suppose arrive at an appropriate range of choices or so. Do I have that right?
Exactly. In my personal case, my plan A was to sell my company to my management team. Plan B was to sell it to a third party.
Yeah.
So I discussed this with the management team, and when we did our strategic planning, the kinds of things we had to do, first of all, I had to build a pretty strong management team. We had written procedures. We managed our financial affairs so that the management team would have the cash flow to buy the company when the time came. So the kinds of things, once you pick an exit strategy, then it gives you information to base your decisions on how you're going to manage the company. That's why I recommend that exit planning be part of strategic planning.
Yes, yes. It's an integrated solution that you're looking for, and it does inform the way you manage your policies,
absolutely,
how you cash flow, the whole picture. You need to see it from that 60,000-foot view. We're visiting with Dick Stieglitz. He's the author of Expensive Mistakes When Buying and Selling Companies and How to Avoid Them in Your Deals. That website, www.57mistakes.com.
There's actually 57 mistakes in the book, David, and each of the chapters starts out with a couple of stories, either from my personal experience or my co-author, who's an M&A attorney. We also interviewed some brokers and some bankers and some CPAs. So there's some interesting stories in there about how owners have botched the sale of their company or didn't prepare it and have actually cost themselves millions of dollars in not preparing their company to be sold.
Wow. So we can look for this in the book. In the time we have together, is there any one story, whether it's a success story or a botched sale like you've just pointed out, that surprised you and would be worth sharing maybe the short form of it here for our audience, just to give them a sense of where these things can go wrong or right?
Well, one of the stories that's up close and personal to me is called organizational ADD. And what I mean by that, you know, I started my own company and I grew it for the first 2 years. The name of my company was RGS Associates, but there were no associates. It was just me. So I grew the company and owned it for 22 years, and I was into every facet of the company, all the way from accounting to sales to project management.
Yeah.
And I think my behavior was typical of small business owners.
Yes. Yes.
Except that when I'm into everything in my company, the management team used to kid me about my idea du jour. I would have a brilliant brainstorm every day. And, yeah, of course, we hadn't finished doing yesterday's or even last week's idea.
Classic entrepreneur.
And that's where they coined the term organizational ADD. And I was the cause of it. And I suspect that many other business owners may be doing the same things in the businesses that they own. So actually building written procedures, repeatable procedures, and building a management team that actually had the authority and latitude to manage was an important thing in building a company that was sellable.
Are there certain types of businesses, and I'm speaking to the business model itself, let's say more virtual organization or an online-based, are some businesses just harder to get to an exit strategy than others?
Well, there are certainly differences depending on what kind of business you have. My particular background is professional services. You know, I'm selling highly skilled people by the hour. Mine was to the federal government. Other businesses are selling products, as in software kinds of things. And then there's, of course, manufacturing business. So there are differences, fundamental differences among those different kinds of business, but they're normally captured in the business ratio, the financial ratios. My CPA helped me develop 17 factors that determined how much my company was worth at any given time. Obviously, who you sell it to determines what it's really worth. Those 17 factors helped me. Was I doing the right things to build value in my business? Now, the implementation of those things is a little different, as I said, depending on what industry you're in.
Yes.
But they're the basic things.
This is really key, the idea of the concept of building value. I mean, entrepreneurs have ideas. They know their widget. They might even be great at operations, but are they thinking about building value all along the way, the 5, 10, 15 years from the start? Once again, we point back to think of the end of the story as you're starting the story, understanding it will change. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the name of the first chapter, the introductory chapter of the book, is Begin with the End in Mind.
There it is.
In an ideal world, when you started a company, you'd know how you were going to get out of it. I rarely see that happen. But certainly when the company gets up to, let's say, $2 million in revenue, maybe even between $1 and $2 million, it's time to start thinking about how am I going to exit from this, even if you're a young person and don't plan on doing that for another 15 to 20 years.
Right.
It's still a good idea because it'll cause you to do the right things to grow your business.
Dick, when you're meeting with business owners, and this may vary based on size and the type of company, what kind of ratios are you looking for? What kind of multiples are you looking for on an exit?
Well, that varies, again, very strongly by the marketplace that you're in. Now, in the government services market, we're generally talking about a multiple, this is professional services, of about 0.8 times revenue. Seven to eight times EBITDA,
yes.
Earnings before income tax, depreciation, and amortization.
So the difference there is almost a factor of eight between top line and bottom line. Do I have that right?
Yeah, a factor of eight on the bottom line and a factor of 0.8 on the top line.
Mm-hmm.
Is a rule of thumb, and again, I'm talking professional services. When you're selling software, if you have proprietary rights to software that you develop, the multiples can be, I've seen multiples as high as 10 times revenue. That's a different ballgame. Let's talk to professional services, because that's what my company was, and that's what I know best. And that's the 0.8 on the bottom line, on the top line, or 8 times the bottom line. And if you go through the math, you'll find that means that if you have about a 10% profit, that's what happens.
Okay. And for that type of business, that's typically what you see, and that's a good target. Are there as many buyers now? We've got a population wave that's aging. How has the landscape changed in terms of supply and demand of businesses that are being sold and businesses that and buyers that are looking for them?
There is a couple interesting demographics going on right now, David. That's a great question. On the seller side, we have a bunch of baby boomers, and I'm personally in that category,
yes.
Who are beginning to think about retirement. So that causes the number of businesses on the market to be higher than it would ordinarily, higher as it has been in the past. The other side of the coin, there tends to be, because of the recession that we're having, that tends actually to be more buyers at the small company level. Consider that you were a mid-range to a senior executive, not the C-level, but below the C-level kind of executive in a company, and you got laid off. So you know how to manage a company, and you're kind of sick and tired of working for somebody else, and you want to start your own business. The way to do it, one of the ways to do it, of course, is to buy someone else's business, and you have a built-in customer base and product and service offering. So actually, with very high unemployment that we have and the rough economy, it tends to increase the number of buyers at the entry level. Again, I'm talking the 2 to 5 million annual revenue. So there's a lot of buyers there, and conversely, there's a lot of sellers now, which, of course, makes the market be a buyer's market. It's
so you're
definitely a buyer's market today.
It is a buyer's market, but you are suggesting some sense of equilibrium because of the supply of businesses for sale and this aging demographic thing that we're experiencing right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and I'm seeing more evidence of some senior managers who are no longer affiliated with a large company who are interested in buying small businesses.
Sure, sure. How's the credit market for buying businesses from your perspective?
Well, as we started, David, that's the hard part. Banks are, generally speaking, not willing to lend money. On the other hand, the SBA is being encouraged to lend more money. Or actually, they don't actually lend the money, because they guarantee the loan. But they're being encouraged to be by the current president to be more liberal in granting SBA loans. So it's a tough market for financing these days, but financing is available.
How unusual, to have the credit part of the equation really, if there's a cog to talk about, that's the one, where you've got willing buyers and sellers, but it's hard to make a market without credit. And it's so fascinating what we're seeing here. I wanted to hit on the subject of finding a price. And we've talked about multiples a little bit, but let's just talk about the typical small micro business. How do they come up with price? Is it there's math to this, isn't there?
There absolutely is a math. It's actually at the let me call it the micro business level, under 2 million. We're actually talking about what is the free cash flow to the prospective buyer. Now, that includes things like the salary that the current owner is taking out of the business, or should be taking out of the business,
yeah.
Plus the bonuses, plus the benefits. Of course, when we own our own business, the dividing line between our personal finances and the corporate finances is a little bit fuzzy.
That's right.
So a lot of times we're getting non-taxable benefits from the company. that reduce our salary and therefore reduce our tax burden.
Yes.
When the buyer comes in, they will credit that to the free earnings of the company. So, for example, if I have a golf membership that might cost me $10,000 a year, now that's an expense of the company, but from the buyer's perspective, they would add $10,000 more to the bottom line.
Okay, so it's like an add back almost.
It's an add back, right.
Wow.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, if I'm not paying myself a fair salary, they'll subtract some for that.
Okay. Fair enough.
But it's really, what's the free cash flow, and we're talking about the very small businesses here, the free cash flow to the prospective buyer. How much cash am I going to get out from my investment? If I'm going to be investing $1 million, I need a cash flow that's going to be $250,000 or more a year.
All right. So as the buyer, you're simply looking at ROI, really,
exactly.
In a very real way.
Precisely.
Whether you're working in the business actively or not.
Yes.
It's fascinating. We've been visiting with Dick Stieglitz. He's the author of Expensive Mistakes When Buying and Selling Companies and How to Avoid Them in Your Deals. Dick has been sharing his insights on mergers, acquisitions, and for the small business owner, exit strategies. The website is www.57mistakes.com. Dick, we'll do it again. Thanks so much for joining us.
By the way, if anyone's interested in those 17 factors that determine the value of a business, they're on the website, 57mistakes.com. You can download them there.
Absolutely. www.57mistakes.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, David.
Small Biz America.
The brain.
Online at smallbizamerica.com.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America.